So one of the realizations after the Great Recession that many business people had was that there was a lot of housing that was available for cheap after all the foreclosures and everything that happened. But the challenge technologically was, well, how are you going to organize all this rental housing? So what was born was basically the housing platform, corporate housing, I guess it's known, which was and is a technological solution to renting, you know, thousands and hundreds of thousands of houses at once. And, you know, the approach to that is breaks from the traditional model of renting, which has been more about small landlords. Now, landlords, of course, can always be a little bit difficult, but corporate landlords, I think what distinguishes corporate landlords is a sort of relentlessness in the profit-seeking behavior.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of eastern Iowa, northwestern Illinois. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and today, you know, if you're like me, you're reading and hearing a lot about the role of big technology firms in our economy and the implications for our democracy. I've been waiting for a book that really helps break this down, somebody like me with limited tech knowledge and skills that explains us in an understandable way what's going on and how important this is and what a challenge it is to our country. Well, the good news is this book has arrived and the author is my guest today. He's Tim Wu, and the book is called The Age of Extraction, How Tech Platforms Conquered the Economy and Threatened Our Future Prosperity. And for our listeners, I think this is worth a listen to find out more about this important topic. Tim, thank you so much for taking the time to be my guest today.
Yeah, sure. It's a pleasure to be here.
Just a little bit of background. You're a specialist. You were served as special assistant to the president for technology and competition policy, so you had a front row seat on a lot of this. But what I really liked was you took us back to to when the internet first came and the promise it had for our economy and our politics. Can you go back first and kind of remind everybody what the great future that what a lot of advocates portended for this technology?
Yeah, no, part of why I wrote this book is as I kind of wanted to understand what happened to the promise in the 90s that the internet was going to make everybody rich. You know, just that fundamental idea that here comes this technology. It's going to support a lot of small businesses. Anyone with any kind of talent, anyone who wants to run a side business is really going to make it. And I should also say it was also going to turn the whole world into democracy as well, and freedom-loving, you know, justice-admiring kind of places around the world. So a lot of that promise did not come true. And basically, this book is the story of what happened.
And what did happen? I mean, I because I remember that time, and I remember first learning all this. You're right. Economically, it was gonna help, and it certainly has. I mean, there's no question about that. Communications, but up to a point. But what happened economically that kind of stunted that progress and kind of put us in the position that we're in now?
I mean, I think it's, you know, it's a long history and it's a full book, but I think the story is that in the early days, I think the internet and the web and a lot of the new platforms did make possible a lot of new types of business and activities, you know, small sellers on eBay or Amazon selling new inventions, people, you know, with their channels. The thing that increasingly has happened over the last 15 years, however, is that the big platforms have taken most of the spoils. And that, I think, is the problem. Because I think on the one hand, it did make possible a new kind of generation of stores and ways of generating wealth. The problem is that about 15 years ago, I think the platforms got really wise to the idea that they could take the big stake, that they could take the lion's share of the new profits. And I think that's become the problem with the internet economy.
I think it's important here to for you to just you use the word platform a lot. which maybe listeners aren't as familiar with in this context. If you could just kind of define that for us for the rest of the interview, because it's an important concept to understand your book.
It's a central concept in this book, and I think a central economic concept to our age. I mean, in some ways, if before the 19th century, the main form of economic power was agricultural, if the 20th century was all about industrial power, 21st century is really about platform power. And the platform is a word that refers to the place or the technology where things happen, where transactions occur. You know, in ancient times, it would be the ancient city square where merchants came to sell their stuff. You know, later on, it became things like the stock market or the fish market or even the grocery store. Our times, it is clearly the online platforms that are the dominant platforms. And just to be sort of technical about the definition, it is the space, you know, say on Amazon Marketplace, where sellers can sell their wares or their new products, and we go there to buy them. And, you know, there's not a single civilization that doesn't have important platforms. This fall I went to Rome with my family, and we were walking around, you know, ancient Rome, and there's the Forum, which was ancient marketplace, also where they gave political speeches, also where the judiciary was housed. Everything has to happen somewhere, and the platforms are the places. So understanding both the importance of the platform, but also I think critically the power of the platforms and their take from the rest of the economy is really key to my book, but also understanding our economy.
Couple of examples that people I think can relate to, and I again, the value of this book was a lot of good things I liked about it, but just kind of reminding me of how this transpired in history was Amazon. I had forgotten they started out just as a bookseller, and I'd forgotten all about that. But talk a little bit about, again, that's an example Tim uses for our listeners of a platform. How did Amazon grow and begin, you know, going beyond just being the platform to being more of I guess, a big player and more of a monopolistic in its practices?
Yeah, I think Amazon is kind of the central, one of the central stories of this narrative, because Amazon promised to deliver on that sort of central promise of the internet, that anyone could, you know, set up a store, and reach a lot of people and make a lot of money. And, you know, it's a really attractive model. I personally am a big believer that we should be a country with a lot of distributed wealth all around the country, as opposed to just a few pockets of wealth. I think that's the American tradition. And Amazon in the early days really promised to deliver on it. They developed the market. First, they were once upon a time just a bookstore. Then they developed this thing called the marketplace. And they realized something really important, which is that sellers needed a way to ship their stuff. eBay never had this, but they understood that the consummation or the fulfillment of the sale was really important. They also understood the importance of having a great search engine. So they did a lot of technological stuff. And there was a time, you know, roughly around 2010 or so, where it really was a serious source of wealth creation. I have a lot of stories in my book about there was this like barber in Indiana who started his own, you know, side hustle, side store selling pomade, you know, men's hair products. And it was this little thing, but then it kind of blew up, and you know, he started making millions of dollars. He hired a bunch of people. A lot of them were war veterans or other or people laid off during the Great Recession. And you know, he it was great. And a key number was really important. In the early days of Amazon, their take was below 20%. So, you know, if you sold $100 worth of merchandise, Amazon took less than $20 of that, which was a pretty good profit center for a lot of people. The problem is that Amazon, once it had sort of captured the market, both on the buyer and the seller side, once they'd become the dominant marketplace, and I mean really dominant, I mean they're like an order of magnitude bigger than any of their competitors, eBay or Etsy or even Walmart Marketplace. Then they started turning up the prices on everything, and it just got worse and worse for the sellers. And you know, they kind of always hid things so the buyers weren't affected, but the sellers had their margins attacked one way or another. And part of it was fees, One of the things I talk about in the book is the rise of Amazon advertising, which is the kind of thing that seems innocuous, but really, really has changed selling. And I say that because, when you search for something on Amazon and you get, kind of the sponsored results, those may seem innocuous, but they are a source of billions and billions in profit for Amazon as the sellers bid against each other to be the favorite search result. In my book, I did research, and Amazon made over $56 billion in 2024 from that one little product. So, $56 billion, almost no cost. I was looking to recently, 2025, I think it's going to be over $70 billion. It's the biggest cash cow. It might be, in terms of cost, one of the purest cash cows in the American economy for something that actually makes the product worse because the search becomes more confusing. And the end result is that sellers, it really is different. The fellow I mentioned, the pomade guy, he went out of business. He couldn't afford it. Many sellers are just playing huge, instead of 20, the 20%, 50, even more than 50% as they bid down their margins. It mainly is people who import Chinese goods or Chinese companies who've been able to succeed on the marketplace. So it has transformed what it is. It is no longer a way, as it once might have been for American sort of middle class to make a little fortune, and has become just a reinforcement of some of the inequalities in our time.
I wanted to use another example that our listeners probably are aware of. They're probably like me. They have some involvement with some of these platforms, like Amazon. I use it, Amazon Prime, but also Facebook, and how Facebook really went about eliminating competition.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. I mean, I want to say it's really hard. I mean, the nature of these platforms is they're essential. It's very hard to do without them. It's like telling a Roman you can't go to the forum. I mean, these are our forum. And I guess, as a slight diversion, these in some ways are our public spaces, though they're privately owned. Like they are where Facebook's a great example. I mean, that's where people see friends and family, sometimes who you don't sometimes you see them more than you see them in person. There's people I know who I just haven't seen in ages. Well, Facebook is another, I think, example. I think early on, the amazing thing about Facebook is they promised to be more protective of your privacy than anybody else. That's how they first became popular, which seems hard to believe. Yeah, that was their initial promise. They were also better run, and it may seem amazing to any younger listeners, but were once considered cool. Facebook was this, cool new thing. That sounds crazy. But I think Facebook, first of all, has been obviously non-protective of privacy, and so they basically reneged on their early promises. When I was in government, we sued them. And I remember one of the startling things to me in the early Facebook. Sorry, I guess the middle-aged Facebook is that they had all these dials that you could turn to increase your privacy, but many of them were fake. In other words, you would do these little things to try to protect yourselves, but they didn't honor those promises. And it was pretty shocking. But the main thing they did to stay in power was they bought many of their most dangerous competitors. It might have been a little different, better if Instagram and WhatsApp had been separate companies, but they were bought by Facebook. And Facebook has done nearly anything it can to resist competitive threats. Obviously, TikTok is something of a challenge, but that core family and friends marketplace, they've never allowed a challenger to emerge.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today, I'm very delighted to have as my guest, Tim Wu, who's the author of The Age of Extraction, How Tech Platforms Conquered the Economy and Threaten Our Future Prosperity. Tim is the Julius Silver Professor of Law, Science, and Technology at Columbia Law School, and he's also served as the special assistant to the president for technology and competition policy. He's the author of two other books, The Master Switch and The Attention Merchants. We're talking about this book today, and Tim's provided kind of some background on it, a definition of platform for our listeners, talked a little bit about Amazon and Facebook as two examples. These businesses have obviously grown, and everybody sees this platform idea and threat in terms of technology. But I thought one of the best chapters of the book, and the entire book I really like, but you also point out two examples of non-tech for people that I'd like you to talk about briefly. That's in housing and healthcare, how these platforms have really taken off.
Yeah, one of the things that I talk about in the book is the fact that the outsized profit of the platforms in tech started to attract other businesses, particularly in housing and medical services, particularly hospital services. And here it was different companies, more private equity than tech companies or anything like that. And maybe I'll start with housing. So one of the realizations after the Great Recession that many business people had was that there was a lot of housing that was available for cheap after all the foreclosures and everything that happened. So that era you had but the challenge technologically was, well, how are you going to organize all this rental housing? So what was born was basically the housing platform, corporate housing, I guess it's known, which was and is a technological solution to renting, you know, thousands and hundreds of thousands of houses at once. And, you know, the approach to that breaks from the traditional model of renting, which has been more about small landlords. Now, landlords, of course, can always be a little bit difficult, but corporate landlords, I think what distinguishes corporate landlords is a sort of relentlessness in the profit-seeking behavior. Yeah. You know, when you look carefully, they never miss a rent increase, very aggressive about fees of every kind and all kinds of business models, just with the idea of just taking the most they can. And, you know, I understand business wants to do that, but when it gets very organized towards trying to maximize profit on something like housing, which no one can do without, it really hurts, I think, our country and our economy. So housing is one area. Medical care is another area where you've seen a lot of practice groups become platformized. And here, it's sort of the same technological or business move, which is you organize a group, you take a lot of the logistics and consolidate into a platform, and you intermediate. So the patients are the, you know, customers, but in a sense, the doctors themselves, it's hard to necessarily portray doctors as victims, but in some ways they are victims of this setup, because the new owners of the healthcare platforms realized to really make money, what they need to do is to squeeze the doctors and make doctors, you know, work longer hours, see patients for less, prescribe more, diagnose more stuff, just like maximize the profit. And, you know, I have a lot of friends who are doctors who said the practice has really transformed. It's also reached veterinary medicine, where, you know, obviously the patients can't complain because they're animals, where they've, really tried to squeeze the most out of both sides. So, you know, the prices are all higher. But then at the same time, the doctors, you know, work longer hours, see patients less time. So I think both these forces, it's this sort of middleman effect, where you get in the middle between, a doctor and the patient, and you try to squeeze the money of the middle. It's the same thing going on in Amazon, where, like, maybe there's a guy selling you a better mousetrap, and maybe you have a house with mice, but it's the middleman who's taking all the money. And I think that has become just the nature of the U.S. economy. This is platform power. It's a middleman who doesn't, you know, who is essential, but at some level is not the producer, is not the consumer. They're the intermediary, and they're grabbing all the money out of these out of the economy for doing, I would say, comparatively little.
Your book does an excellent job in talking about how these tech platforms especially try to use emotions, the addictive power of feedback, couch lock. I like that term. And the role of convenience and dependency. And it is. It just, and this leads to, I think, some of the big problems we have right now. And you add to that how you describe how the use of data and all the gathering all this data on people. And we're just hit, bombarded by this constantly. And it's not good. I think there's a consensus forming that this really isn't good for people's mental health.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I don't want to be any kind of conspiracy theorist, but I don't think there's any question. And I've studied extensively the history of advertising and the role of in a book before this, The Attention Merchants. And I think it's very apparent that business understands the importance of human emotions. And for the platforms in particular, a loyalty verging on dependence is really important. Because in some ways, the platforms are a little bit like casinos in the sense that it doesn't matter what you do there as long as you're there. Like, what really matters is the time. So, who cares if you're on Facebook hanging with your friends, chatting or whatever? Who cares, what you're doing on Google? What matters is that you are there and that you do not leave. And one way or another, they will make money off of it. Whether it's fees from transactions, whether it's selling your attention to advertisers, whether it's harvesting data to make other products, that's the key. So the time is the ultimate resource here. And there's a number of things. I think relatively well chronicled is the development of addictive behaviors. And if you're like me, you probably can't resist checking in on your Facebook, maybe use Twitter. I don't know, take whatever it is, you got to check in and see what's going on. And like, did you miss anything? Email. So there's that. But there's also, it's very powerful. In another book, I discuss the first email addict, who was a guy in the 70s who carried this massive, like 5-pound computer with him everywhere because he'd gotten addicted to email and he'd plug it into
Oh
a phone jack. He was the first victim of something we all have now. Although, gosh, email has been so, the goal is, and it's a natural business goal, is to try to create dependence. In this book, I talk about the power of convenience, and it really becomes hard. Once you get used to Amazon or something like that, it's really, really hard to say, even for a cheaper price, I'm going to go out here and find this thing, and oh man, it's such a pain. So that is where the war is being waged right now, and I'm not trying to say, okay, go live in a cave and don't use any conveniences. But it is important to realize that we are, in some ways, becoming very dependent, almost like unable to live without our cocoons. I have that phrase, convenience cocoons, that like we've become like we have these suits of armor that we're strong when we wear them, but we take them off, we're quite weak and dependent.
So now we have artificial intelligence, though. Is that going to
Oh
extend
my
this
God.
platform monopoly, or is that going to break it?
I think it's a key question. I'm glad you've obviously read this book carefully, because that I think is one of the real key questions, is whether artificial intelligence serves to reinforce the power of the platforms or challenges them. I think that challenges are really important in American industrial history. I think it's good to have a challenger every so often because companies can become stagnant. So, the optimistic side of me says, okay, well, maybe, I don't know, OpenAI will lead some challenge and, a better age or something like that. But I'm a little nervous that artificial intelligence takes a different step because it doesn't create virtual versions of things. Instead, it makes decisions for people. So it gets co more at the core of what it means to be us. The internet was like, I was talking about the Roman Forum. It was like, the online version of it. You do this, you do that, but you're still in charge, nominally, but you're still in charge. Artificial intelligence is offers some risk of a different form of dependence, where you can't really do anything else much. You can hardly write or do math or any of the things we used to do. You kind of lay back, and that is almost a more existential challenge. And certainly, if you get really dependent, you can't. You can imagine that there's only a few companies going to be able to survive in that environment.
Kim, what in a nutshell, we've got about 5 minutes left here, 4 minutes. We're not going to get to all my questions, unfortunately, but that's okay. People should go buy the book and read it. What's the threat in a nutshell to our economy and our democracy? We're seeing a lot more talk about this right now, especially you see Elon Musk's name, Mark Zuckerberg. What's the threat in short to the platform monopoly to our economy and our democracy?
Yeah, and I'm sorry for going on so long.
No,
Obviously,
no,
I
no,
care
no, no. That's our.
passionately about this topic. But I'm a historian of among other things, industrial history and related political developments. And I'll just say great imbalances in private power, great wealth imbalances tend to lead to stability, dissatisfaction, economic insecurity, and ultimately threats to democracy. I'm a believer that the best thing for a country is to have decentralized wealth, to have money all across the country in many hands, and to have a citizenry that feels economically empowered, and therefore less dissatisfied, less prone to extremism. And I feel that platform power, it's not the only form of out of balance economic power, but it is one of them. And I feel that if people feel that there are companies that are as powerful as governments or have undue influence over government, the less trust they have in such institutions. And I fear we're going in that direction. So I think it's a double-edged threat. One is the threat of the platform firms using their position in the middle of everything just to take from every sector of the economy. We talked about healthcare, we talked about housing, talked about, buying things, selling things. I think there's not a sector of the economy it is not somewhat at risk of being hollowed out by tech platforms. And then I think the more that happens, the angrier people get, the more distrustful, the sense that they don't believe in democracy anymore gets stronger. And that, I think, is a very dangerous direction if you've read any history of the 20th century.
I guess we can close with this. I got about a couple minutes left, but I mean, I think a lot of listeners are like me. They're aware of this. They use Facebook. They use Amazon. They were aware of the housing and healthcare platform issues. I certainly, when I read it, I thought, oh, that explains it. I mean, you talk about the architecture of equality, some things at the end. There's five. Is there one in particular that you think you'd like to emphasize here in, say, a minute and a half?
Well, I believe in the antitrust, and I guess we need to constantly watch private power using antitrust law. I guess if things go further, we need at some point to start thinking of the biggest tech platforms more like utilities that, need to be under some level of control. And we don't say the electric company, okay, charge whatever you want. we got to be careful. So if things just get too far, I'm not saying for everything, but we may need like some serious limits on just how much of the economy is being taken. At a personal level, I think it's very hard to say, okay, just avoid the platforms because that's crazy. You want to be like in
Yeah.
touch with your family. But I do patronize some of the alternatives when I can. But you also have to be realistic.
Book is called The Age of Extraction, How Tech Platforms Conquered the Economy and Threaten Our Future Prosperity. It's written by Timothy Wu. Tim's been my guest today on Heartland Politics. I really urge listeners to get to go get a copy of this book because, again, if you're like me, sometimes the language gets a little overwhelming, complicated, and Tim does a great job of breaking this down and making this very approachable, somewhat complex topic, very approachable. And I really highly recommend it. It's an important book, very timely. Tim, thank you again for being my guest today on Heartland Politics.
Thank you for having me on. Really appreciate your thoughtful questions.
You've been listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. You can follow Heartland Politics at WVIK.org or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.